This is 100 Things I'll Miss When I'm Dead. I'm Michael Koval Anderson. Welcome to My Happy Place, my podcast where I self-medicate against my constant overthinking about my own mortality with tiny happy pills of positivity. If you're enjoying the podcast, you can buy me a coffee. Check out my page at buymeacoffee.com/Michael. That's M-I-K-A-E-L. Well, I guess this podcast is moving along nicely. I set the every Wednesday deadline for publishing each episode for myself, but it's getting a little bit stressing. I don't even have all 100 things yet. I have about 80, and I figured that I would keep thinking of other things as I went along, which I'm doing. I work well with deadlines, so my fingers are crossed. One decision I made at the beginning of this journey was not to include people. That would take up a number of spots on the list if I did. I'm not looking to make a franchise out of this idea, but 100 people I'd miss when I'm dead, 100 foods, 100 places, the potential is certainly there. But there are some people included. I'm not missing them specifically, even though I will, and I do. But it's something about them and their influence on my life. Let's get to it. Welcome to Episode 5. Number 26. Not owning stuff. I don't know how to break this to you gently. I'm an educated and employed father of two in his 50s, and yet I don't own anything. At least not anything that would cause society to smile down upon me. I rent my apartment and own no property elsewhere. If I think about my most valuable possessions, it would probably be a list of bikes and camera equipment. That's about it. I am well aware that, in the eyes of many of my contemporaries, I am letting the team down. I have failed miserably at fulfilling the economic expectations of human society that were spawned by the agricultural revolution. Instead of trying to rectify the situation and sit all schoolboy rigid across a desk from bank employees while they peruse with pursed lips a stack of documents that prove my worth in the eyes of society at large, and beg for a loan that would enable me to acquire important things, I decided to see if I could scale back. Even if I take stock of important things that I have owned in my life, the list is unlikely to excite. I owned 2 cars back in the 80s. One was a used Lada, which, when I come to think of it, is the only car I bought on my own, because the other car was a used Ford Falcon station wagon that I bought when backpacking through Australia. I split the $800 price tag with 2 Norwegians that I met on the plane from Auckland. There was 0 return on investment on that beastly vehicle. It ended up dying, and I left it parked somewhere in a Sydney suburb in early 1990. Together with my ex-wife, I bought an apartment in a co-op here in Copenhagen. After we split up, we agreed that she would buy me out, which she did. My career as a property co-owner lasted about as long as a professional footballer, around a decade. Taking stock of what I own now is more difficult because, well, to be honest, I don't really care. I have never measured myself based on my possessions. For the purpose of this piece, I have attempted it. I have some bikes. 2 cargo bikes, 2 vintage Swedish bikes from the 1950s, and my daily ride. Estimated total value, 7,500 euros. My camera equipment, including lights, mics, lenses, and all that, is probably worth around the same. Okay, what else can I figure out here? I have a designer sofa, 1,300 euros. A vintage Ellipse dining table by Piet Hein, 500 euros. A vintage 7 chair by Arne Jacobsen, 200 euros. A vintage Ole Vanscher easy chair, PJ112, 400 euros. Lots of camping and sports equipment, 1,500 euros. A ring inherited from my dad, 2,000 euros. My laptop and smartphones, 3,300 euros. And yeah, you know what? I got tired just having to think about all of this. Let me just get some disclaimers out of the way here. I'll happily admit that I get a kick out of buying things. Hey, I'm not a monster. I experience the same sense of wonder and thrill as anyone else when firing up a new laptop or reverently lifting the new Samsung smartphone out of the box. If I fork out some hard-earned cash on a product, I enjoy the Pavlovian response in myself. I can also admit to having certain consumer weaknesses. For reasons I've never fully analyzed in my own head, I seem to fancy sunglasses, and I have about 20 different pairs. I like footwear and luggage. Perhaps that reflects how I enjoy traveling to warm destinations and walking around a lot in the sun, or a desire to do much more of it. I have a wardrobe fully acceptable to the high Danish style standards. I'm not a slob. But I can't decide if it's more akin to peer pressure or outright bullying, this obsession with us owning stuff. Don't get me wrong. I embrace the solidarity of our Danish society and the sense of teamwork and togetherness that is so deeply rooted here. I am proud that my taxes are part of this well-oiled machine. I just find it odd that I'm expected to do what some old white dudes decided in previous centuries was best for all of us. Even if I am now in that old white dude demographic, it is in appearance only, and I am acutely aware of the destructive influence men in suits and uniforms have had on humankind and have no desire to join that club. Nor do I find it dignified that I, or anyone, should be regarded as a worker bee slaving away for the benefit of a queen. I realize that in other parts of the world, the scramble for investments in property and stocks starts early and is a necessity. Homes will be inherited by children and grandchildren. Car-centric cities force people to buy cars because no other options are available for getting around. Parents have to start saving early to pay for their kids' university instead of the state paying you to attend higher education, as is the case here in Denmark. This doesn't mean we can't continue to question the obsession with buying and owning. In one conversation with a property-laden friend, I was asked, a little accusingly, who benefits from you? He meant my lack of ownership of things. Who benefits from me? Apart from Danish society through my social contribution and taxes? Well, hopefully my children. Maybe I'm doing an okay job at parenting. Hopefully citizens in cities through my work as an urban designer, making cities better. Hopefully the viewers of my TV series, The Life-Size City, as I curate passionate people in cities around the world and show that urban change is possible and imminent. Oh, and yeah, my local wine bar. Damn, they benefit from me. As well as restaurants, local shops, hotels, at home and abroad. I was irritated by the question from that friend, but I was pleased to have to think about it and come out just fine with the result. I grew up in a modest, proud, working-class home where nothing was taken for granted. My mother taught me that it was my actions that counted and hammered home the importance of working to make the world a better place. I hope the team is okay with that. I'd just rather be than to have. Not that it will matter much when I'm dead. Number 27. Missing my mother. It sounds counterintuitive, doesn't it? When I'm dead and gone, I'm going to miss missing my mother, who passed into the void in 2006. I would prefer she was still with us, absolutely, but I can't change the fact that she's not. It's a dagger to my heart every time I think about the fact that she never met my daughter, or that she never experienced the development of my career. But I'll miss her popping into my head at random. I'll miss thinking about something and thinking, I should tell her about that, only to realize that it's quite impossible. The gravity of that is epic and never-ending, that regret and sadness and monstrously heavy irreversibility. It's an anchor, sometimes around my ankle, but most often just attached, as intended, to my ship, keeping it safe for a time. Barbara was a matriarch, in the finest old-school sense. She was the unchallenged mafia boss of our huge family. You didn't dare sit on her chair at the end of the dining room table where she did her crosswords, with an epicentral view of the kitchen, the back door, and the living room. Basically the entire hub of the house. She was gruff, no-nonsense, lived through the Second World War tough. When she died, the entire family showed up to pay their respects. It was the greatest and only family reunion on record. I was an added value kid, showing up unexpectedly a full decade after she thought she was done with having children. As a result, my four siblings are between 10 and 18 years older than me, and my adopted little brother is 8 years my junior. I enjoyed a window of time where I was essentially an only child, since the others had grown up and moved out. I had my mother to myself, in a sense. She gave me the freedom to do whatever I wanted, but her eyes were always on me, making sure I wasn't stepping over any lines. Lines determined by her. I regard myself as the proud son of a matriarch. Virtually every valuable thing I learned as a child and young man, I learned from her. I grew up in an open home where everyone was welcome. As a child, I could come home from school and she would inform me that there's a family of eight who are now living in the basement suite. They were forced to flee a dictator in Uganda, so they'll be living here for a couple of months until they get settled. She could have just been saying, we'll be having roast pork and potatoes for dinner. It was simple and matter of fact. When I was about 11, I was walking down the back alley on my way to play football with a friend when I came across a woman in her 20s, sitting in the grass and crying. Awkward for any 11-year-old. I remember passing and then stopping. Are you okay? She looked up. She had a black eye and a bloodied nose. She stammered that she was fine. She clearly wasn't. My first 11-year-old instinct was to walk off and play football. But that was soon overruled by the next instinct. My mom is really good at listening and she helps a lot of people. I just live over there. You can come over for a cup of tea or something. I don't know. She looked at me for a long moment, and then, to my surprise, she agreed. When I walked into the kitchen with a beaten stranger in tow, saying, "Mom, this lady was crying in the back alley," my mother took 2 seconds to appraise the situation, only using her eyes and some minor twitches in her micro-expressions. Then, "I'm Barbara. Here, let me get you a wet cloth for that nose. Have a seat at the table. I'll put the kettle on." I never heard anything like, "That was a really good thing you did. I'm proud of you," from my mother. She turned to me and said, "Don't be late for dinner." But there it was, an imperceptible nod and a certain look in her eye that meant exactly all those things. That episode saw my mother sign up for some organization that helped abused women. Basically, through my entire childhood, I could come home and find strangers in the house. Abused women, drug addicts, troubled neighbors, entire families from Eastern Europe, Uganda, Vietnam living in the basement. Nothing dramatic about that. Just a normal daily life for us. I'll put the kettle on. When she was on her deathbed, and after she died, I kept my son back in Denmark informed about the entire process. He was 4 years old at the time, and I have never wrapped my kids in cotton. Death is a reality, and it's important to confront it head on. But I was left with an issue I needed to solve. She was cremated, and we would be depositing her ashes in the sea, as was her wish. Being very non-religious, I certainly couldn't regurgitate fantastic tales from religions that she was in heaven or someplace like that. There was no gravestone to visit, so I realized I needed to create something for my son, and later my daughter, to remember her by. And then it came to me. I told my son that the first star or planet he sees at night, any night, the rest of his life, was Grandma. She was right there. Of course, it isn't actually her, I told him. I wasn't going to lie to my child. But that is how we remember her. It's like a permanent gravestone in the sky. Others have died in my family since and in my ex-wife's family as well. It's up to my kids to decide the order when they look at the stars. Barbara is first, of course. But the second and third star can be whoever you want to remember. It worked a treat. To this day, if we're out at night, I can just say to my kids, "Give her a wave." And they look up and they say hello. The funny thing is that I'm probably the one who benefits the most from this storytelling I invented for my children. Every first star I see ever since, I say to myself, "Hey, Mom." Then I seek out the second, my dad, the third, my brother, and so on, and say hello to those family members as well. The first star or planet you see is always the brightest, and that fits my mother well. I'll miss missing her when it's my turn to become a star. Number 28, spreadsheets. I readily accept that one of my life's great ironies is that I have an utter disinterest in mathematics, and yet I love spreadsheets. There is something so completely satisfying in arranging data in the cells of rows and columns, and then clicking sum or average and seeing results appear. I use spreadsheets less for documenting and calculating than for seeking out patterns in my life. Because my curiosity gets the better of me, sometimes the patterns are a bit weird. Working in urbanism, I often deal with housing issues and the footprint that people live on. In one spreadsheet, I have a comprehensive list of all the places I've lived in my life. Total, 41. It's divided into columns listing how many square meters of living space I had, either in a rented room, average 35.45 square meters, or the whole place, average 76.7 square meters, the type of home or structure, apartment, shared room and house, etc. Time spent living in each place, average 1.37 years, but if I exclude the 17.5 years spent in my childhood home, the average is 0.96 years. Then there's which cities I've lived in, 17 cities on 4 continents. The ones I've had the most homes in, Copenhagen, 10, Vancouver, 9. Other identifiers such as who I lived with, the dates I lived there, and the address, if I can remember it. I so desperately wish I could add the rent I paid in all these places, but those numbers are lost in time. I have lists documenting my travel days per year, both work and pleasure. Now, 2020 is going to be a bit of a shorter list, but in normal years, I spend an average of 50% of my time on the road. I list cities and countries, type of accommodation, including nights spent on airplanes, purpose of journey, number of restaurants and bars I visited, and so on. There's a list where I record how much garbage I throw out and how much it weighs. Back in 2019, we started sorting food waste here in my city. It shipped off to a biogas facility to generate heat for homes and natural fertilizer. I was curious to see how much food waste my kids and I actually generated, monthly average 9.47 kilograms, and how that impacted the normal household garbage. Reduction, 68%. In a couple of long-distance relationships I've had, I was fascinated by how many texts fly back and forth. In one of them, lasting 18 months, we were pretty prolific. Total texts, 28,299, and monthly average, 2,292. Then I analyzed all the words that we used to find the most frequent ones. Fuck, 2,164. Ha ha, 1,895. Love, 715. Miss you, 506. Sex, 502. Then there's the detailed list of everything I've bought so far this year, every bill I paid over 4 years at my local wine bar, the amount paid, which server, which seat I sat at the bar, time of payment, date. Then there's a rough calculation of how many orgasms I've probably had so far in my life, 11,000 and counting. And a list of sex partners, age, city, hair color, age difference, again, only to see what patterns emerge and if there is a change over time. Which led to a spreadsheet about how many cities have I actually had sex in. And then there's the one I'm working on at the moment, how many cities have I visited in my entire life. I'm at 200 and still counting. I've also used the data to create infographics where I divide my life up into weeks to determine both where I've lived and how many weeks of my life I've, for example, owned a car. Only 217. As you're probably starting to figure out, I'm a big fan of both data and displacement activities. I'm fine with you thinking it's strange, but there is something strangely zen and comforting about creating data out of the regularities of daily life. Number 29, my super nose. Back in late 2001, my first kid was on the way, nestled in the womb of my second wife. It was thrilling and exciting, but of course we just went about our daily lives. Then something started happening. We would be walking around the neighborhood and I would declare, "Hey, I can smell dog shit somewhere." We would both stop up and look around, trying to find it. This repeated itself for several weeks until my ex-wife said, "There's never any dog shit when you say there is." Yeah, I was well aware of that, and it was starting to get irritating. So the next time my nose registered dog shit, we stopped and really looked for it. It took a while, but we finally found the culprit about 20 meters away. "How could you smell that?" she said. I had absolutely no idea. It was weird and like nothing I had ever experienced before in my life. I spent a lot of time thinking about it, analyzing it, trying to figure it out. Now, I knew that pregnant women sometimes experience one or more of their senses being heightened or intensified, especially their sense of taste and smell due to hormonal changes in their body. That is well documented. Often a pregnant woman also suddenly finds certain smells to be quite disgusting for the first time. It seems to be an evolutionary advantage as well, since your heightened senses help detect potential danger to you and your unborn child. At the time, I remember trying to find rabbit holes to fall down on the internet in my search for information about why my own sense of smell was accentuated, and all of a sudden, I recall coming across an article that suggested that the father of an unborn child could also experience an increase in sensory intensity. The theory was much the same, detecting potential dangers to the offspring and the mother. But there was not a lot of information about this topic. But that's what I convinced myself it was, and I was also sure that it would fade after the birth of our child. It was just a quirky, crazy thing. More than 18 years later, I am still stuck with it. I've also learned to accept it and to live with it. It's not an all-dominant force in my life, but it is ever-present. While writing this, I made the mistake of Googling it. Googling anything about medical conditions is never a good idea, since the internet always offers up the negative articles first. I'm sure you've tried that as well. What started with, "Wow, my sense of smell suddenly became more intense, isn't that crazy?" led to me reading about a disorder called hyperosmia. Oh, great. A disorder with a spooky Greek name. Just what I needed. Even the vernacular for this condition, super smeller, isn't much of an improvement. It's certainly not something I'm going to be including on my dating profiles. Once in a while, it can be a bit over the top, but by and large, I can deal with it. Sometimes I put some gamification into it. If I smell something unusual, I'll try and find the source. Basically, nobody who is around me will ever die in a fire or a gas leak because I have a distant early warning system that is incredibly effective. Countless times when I smell something and I have other people around me, I ask, "Hey, can you smell that?" Nobody ever can. It is also incredibly subtle and detailed. I know that other parents can smell when their small children are getting ill because they have bad breath. I've experienced that as well, but I could also just smell it on their skin. Now, personally, I don't get ill very often at all, but if I am feeling under the weather, I can smell it on myself. I can also smell when it's time for me to take a shower. Generally, I'm not a person with a strong body odor, so I know that this is really subtle. I've also learned that nobody else can smell the same thing, so I don't really need to sprint down to the bathroom. Once in a while, it has some weird applications. A girl I was seeing a few years ago sprayed on a bit of the cologne that I have been using for most of my adult life. Later, when we were doing the things that you do when you're seeing someone, my brain had an odd reaction. That particular scent is one that I have learned to associate with myself, and it is one of my favorite scents. But I wasn't wearing it. My olfactory receptors registered it, but it was on a different human. A very different human. It's really hard to describe, but I had this distinct feeling that I was in bed with myself. It got to the point where I asked her to go out and wash it off. Super weird. Which is probably what you're thinking right now. Oh my God, this is so weird. And fair enough. I have spent a lot of time thinking back over my life before I had children to try and remember if this was a thing the whole time. But our sense of smell is so closely related to memory that it's difficult to determine patterns. Apparently, this condition is more often than not associated with unattractive aromas. And while they are the ones that register strongest in my nose, I am pleased to report that positive aromas also feature prominently. I can smell the same things as you, like the scent of grass after the rain, a bakery, or, if you remember episode 3, the silage of my fellow citizens. I just think it's more intense, and I register it from a farther distance. What's interesting about this topic is that I don't think I would miss it, this super smeller thing, if it disappeared as quickly as it appeared. Sometimes I wish I were free of it, but often I think it's kind of cool. It's like a cute little superpower that nobody knows about. Well, okay, except for all of you people listening to this now, but hey, I just like how it makes me feel a little more connected with the animal kingdom. While I can't compete with dogs, I like that I can kind of understand what goes on in their brains when they smell things. As a career opportunity, how cool would it be if I could be trained, like dogs can, to detect cancer in my fellow humans just by sniffing them? That would be an appropriate use of this minor superpower. Instead, I think I'll just take a shower. Number 30, lighting a cigarette. As habits go, whether they're good or bad, there are few that can compare with lighting a cigarette for artistry. Lighting a cigarette spawns a long line of related micro-habits that are so personal to each person that they can easily be regarded as habitual fingerprints. It is endlessly fascinating to watch how other people open a pack, extract a cigarette from said pack, position the lighter in their hand, and how long they spend lighting the leaves. I'm constantly comparing mental notes and analyzing techniques. Little good it does me, since I have my own style, which seems to be carved in stone. It begins with the way one handles the pack, and, by extension, whether it's a hard or soft pack. I prefer the latter. The gentle tapping of the pack, angled downward on the index finger of my left hand. luring the filter of a cigarette out just enough to extract it with my thumb and middle finger. Then the elegant roll to the left as my index finger simultaneously lands on top of the paper tube and the thumb withdraws, leaving it firmly in place between the two primary fingers. I reach for the lighter, wherever it may be, feeling it out with the fingers of my right hand to position it correctly. My hands coordinate their movements now upwards towards my mouth. The filter lands gently on my lower lip, in the middle, and the top lip descends to secure it. My left hand then cups and slides back protectively behind the lighter, whether there's wind or not, as my right thumb rolls back the spark wheel to rest on the fork, allowing the fork spring to compress and release the gas from the jet as the flint spring is allowed to relax and expand, forcing the flintstone up to meet the spark generated by the wheel. The flame rises into existence. It's all so prehistoric. My neck muscles tense as my head pushes forward ever so slightly to meet the flame that my right hand is nudging in the opposite direction. It's a delicate moment, a kiss. And then to feed and expedite the incendiary event, a subtle inhalation of air. My eyes are trained on that spot where flame meets leaves, witnessing this mini supernova, mesmerized by the fire like every human before me. My thumb releases the pressure on the fork, cutting off the gas and killing the flame. My eyes continue to keep watch, ensuring that the leaves are, in fact, alight, as I inhale once again, this time a little bit deeper. The nicotine goes to work, stimulating the adrenal glands and forcing the discharge of adrenaline, which in turn causes an increase in blood pressure, respiration, and heart rate. The pathways in the brain circuitry are rewarded with feelings of pleasure. Then comes the management of the event. It's rather contradictory that the enjoyment of smoking the cigarette is accompanied by the need to concentrate on the length of the ash. I'm a one-tap person, positioning the tip of the cigarette over the ashtray, or just in midair, and tapping once to release the ash. Others employ a series of lighter taps, or roll the tip of the cigarette on the side or bottom of the ashtray to create a cone. It takes, on average, 5 to 7 minutes to smoke a cigarette. The final act of extinguishment is as varied as you can get. I subscribe to the art of forcing the tip downwards for a moment before folding the filter over and squishing the remains of the cigarette flat. There are both rougher and gentler approaches, with a myriad of nuances. Like many others in my generation, I smoked too much for years, and I certainly don't miss it. Weirdly, I started late, at the age of 26. I stopped around 7 years ago, but I still enjoy one now and then, simply because I enjoy it. It's like having a glass of whiskey once in a while. Even my family doctor is so very pragmatically Danish about it. She just rolls her eyes and makes me promise to keep the levels as low as that, after checking that I eat healthy, get exercise, etc. As she puts it, there are so many things worse than that. If cigarettes disappeared tomorrow, I wouldn't miss them. If it comes up in conversation in North America that I partake of tobacco products on occasion, I counter that shock-horror reaction with, well, at least I don't own a car. The confused looks on faces are priceless. A few years ago, I asked a doctor friend about the health warnings on cigarette packs and whether they should also be applied to cars and motorists. She confirmed that they should. I made a series of graphics featuring fancy cars with huge health warnings on all sides to illustrate the point that we need to look differently at driving in cities. But I'm not here to talk about my work. I have another podcast for that. Far fewer people smoke here in Europe, which is great. But many of my fellow citizens still do. Luckily, our culture is not a shaming culture. I'm all for raising the prices of cigarettes, anonymous packaging, smoke-free environments, you name it, all good. But we also need to address, driving, alcoholism, gambling addiction, lifestyle illnesses, and the really destructive one for our societies, obesity. We have our work cut out for us. You've been listening to 100 Things I'll Miss When I'm Dead. If you like the podcast, I would be thrilled if you wanted to buy me a coffee. You can check out how at buymeacoffee.com/Michael. That's MIKAEL. The music I use is by Phil Creamer and Mikael Gjul. Me? I'm Michael Koval Anderson. Catch you next time, and thanks for listening.